So good evening, everyone. Here at Sherbrooke Street, there at Wall Street, and out there in the Zoom realm, wherever you all are. If you feel comfortable putting your video on, that's fine, and it's also fine if you don't. So this is the fourth and last installment of this series that we've been doing. Oh, yeah, do people have their chant books at Wall Street? It appears they do, yeah. So we've been talking about a poem from 9th century China that we sometimes chant. It's on page 10, and it's called The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Said to be composed by Dongshan, who founded our particular tradition of Zen in China a very long time ago. And it's said to be a kind of teaching that he passed on to his successor, and then traditionally was passed on from one Zen master to the next. So I hope that those of you who've been following along, and don't worry if you haven't, but I hope that those of you who have, with the help of a little decoding, have begun to kind of enter into Dongshan's world and to see that it's not so different from ours as we might think, even 1,000 years later. The human condition seems to endure. With all its trials and tribulations and its joys and beauty. So just to review a little bit, the jewel mirror in the title is our Buddha nature. Our nature unbound by conditioning, unobscured by what we call the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And this condition of clear mind is samadhi, so jewel mirror samadhi. And when we see, when we look into that jewel mirror with our dharma eye, we see Buddha nature reflected all around us. Our Buddha nature is reflected in everyone else and everything that we see. We can't even really say our Buddha nature because it doesn't belong to us. It's what we are. So, picking up where we left off last time, which is towards the bottom of the second page, towards the bottom of page 11, we read that Dongshan was comparing some of his Zen students to a terrified, tethered colt or a cowering rat. He says, outwardly still while inwardly moving like a tethered colt, a trapped rat. The ancient sages pitied them and bestowed upon them the teaching. So this is some of us. Sometimes we sit in zazen, unmoving, but inside we're terrified. We go through life rigid and tense, defended with our minds in turmoil, trembling inside, heart pounding. And so the sages take pity on us and give us the teachings and the Dharma. So he continues in the next lines, saying, according to their delusions, they called black as white. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. If you want to conform to the ancient way, please observe the sages of former times. So he's saying that when we're caught in the delusion of of self, you know, that our self is somehow substantial and separate from everything else. When we're caught up in that delusion, we are calling black white. So you have to remember some of the earlier lines where in the metaphor, black or night is the reality of oneness, the absolute connectedness, and white or daylight is the reality of the relative, of differentiation, because we can see differences, right, in the daytime. And these are not two separate realities, they are one and the same reality, two aspects to the same reality that exists in every moment. And he's saying when we see only the relative, we're seeing black as white. So that's what this line means. And we're not seeing that we, our being, exists in this dynamic matrix of being along with everything else. When we do see into the jewel mirror of samadhi, those three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance are transformed into medicine to heal ourselves and the world. So the poison of greed, when it's released from that self-focus, that self-clinging, transforms into compassion and caring. And the poison of aversion or hatred, when it's released from self-clinging, transforms into what's called discriminating wisdom, so we can see clearly and have discernment that comes from a place of clear seeing and care, not self-interest. And the poison of delusion transforms into what we could call clear seeing equanimity, even-handedness. So when those conditioned habit patterns drop away, that bright, clear light of awareness shines equally on all things. Like that line earlier in the poem, the white egret in the moonlight, in the snow. This is the ancient way, the sages of old, the way of the sages of old that he's referring to. And next he gives us a curious example. He says, when about to fulfill the way of Buddhahood, one gazed at a tree for 10 eons. So this, one interpretation of this is that the Buddha took 10 eons or kalpas, going through 10 long stages before becoming fully enlightened. But there's a more interesting interpretation that refers to a story of a mythical king in the Lotus Sutra, who was his Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha in a past life, who sat in zazen for 10 kalpas without attaining enlightenment, even though his 16 sons all managed to attain enlightenment. So you have to realize that a kalpa is an unimaginable length of time, so 10 kalpas is even more unimaginable. A kalpa is said to be the time it takes for a massive mountain to wear down to nothing. If a heavenly being flies over once a year and just brushes it with her silk sleeve. That's a long time. So this same character, appears in a koan, an old story in the Gateless Gate or Mumon Khan collection. Instead of the king in the Lotus Sutra, it's a mythical Buddha who sits in zazen for 10 kalpas. And the dialogue in this old story goes like this. The Buddha, excellent in great penetrating wisdom, that was his name, practiced meditation on the seat of awakening for 10 ages, 10 kalpas. Nonetheless, he did not experience the great awakening. Why? Oh, this was a monk asking his teacher, the Zen master. And his teacher, Xingyang, replied, your question touches the intimate matter. the central question. So the monks, that's not much of an answer. And so he asks again, but he sat on the seat of awakening. Why didn't he attain Buddhahood? And Xingyang replied, because he is a non-attained Buddha. There's a koan for you. What's a non-attained Buddha? If we go into this koan, as much as I am tempted to, we won't get through the song of the jewel mirror samadhi. But I want to consider the comment that Wu Men, who made this collection of koans, makes. He says, if an ordinary person realizes, they are thus a sage. If a sage understands, they are thus an ordinary person. Nothing special. The sage realizes and then is just an ordinary person. The koan and this comment are pointing us beyond that the duality of nirvana and samsara, delusion and enlightenment. What is a Buddha who is non-attained, a sage, or an ordinary person? Here's the verse that the old Zen masters who made these collections of old stories, of old dialogues and stories, would then make a comment and a verse. And this is his verse. Better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer anxious. When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble. Well, given what we know of neuroscience these days, I have to take issue with the first two lines, which say, better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer anxious. We know now that the mind and body are inseparable, that the brain-mind extends throughout the body. And we know that when we calm and regulate the body, that the body is calming and regulating body and mind happen reciprocally. By that I mean when we bring patient awareness to body and breath, the mind eases. And when we attend to mental activity, noticing and letting go, without clinging or pushing away, the body eases. It's reciprocal. There's no way we can actually separate mind and body. The second two lines of the verse, when body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble, resonates with some lines that are coming further in the poem. We'll come to that. But let's just go to the next line. The next line goes, like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray. Well, interpretations of this line vary quite a bit. Even the scholars don't always agree on how to interpret a text that is 1,000 years old. The Chinese literally says, like a tiger that is broken or impaired in some way, and like a horse with white back legs, which suggests old age. You know, horses turn a little white like dogs do, and like we do as we get older. I'll spare you the somewhat wildly differing comments by scholars. But there's a kind of a shaky consensus that both the tiger and the horse are venerable. They've been through a lot. They're getting old. Maybe like that old king sitting in zazen for 10 kalpas. Weathered and worn, but with a certain dignity. I think maybe the point here is that attainment isn't a once and for all static thing that can be accomplished, that can be attained. Maybe that poor old king had never had a big bang, earth-shaking, lightning strike enlightenment experience through all those long kalpas, but he was practicing an awakening all along. Dogen, who founded our school of Zen in Japan, says over and over again that practice, realization, and actualization are all simultaneously unfolding, are continuous. Not separate, not linear, manifesting in a dynamic way in the moment, in space and time. Next lines. Because there is the common, there are jewel pedestals, fine clothing. Because there is the startlingly different, there are house cat and cow. These are lines that when people first read this, your reaction is just, what on earth is he talking about? So a little decoding. The first line is referring to another story from the Lotus Sutra. It's a kind of like a prodigal son story, for those of you who know the story of the prodigal son from the Bible. In this case, there's a rich man's son who leaves home and squanders his fortune on drinking and gambling and general dissolution. And when he is ultimately reduced to complete ruin, he somehow he's wandering, living on the streets, and he somehow stumbles back into his father's estate and does not recognize where he is, and he does not recognize his father. His father is dressed in fine robes with his feet resting on a jewel footstool. So that's the line in the poem. So the father tells his estate manager to give the son a job cleaning the stables. In other words, shoveling shit. But this is not meant to humiliate the son. He's already sunk as low as he can go. It's meant, and it does work, to gradually build back his trust and confidence. And that's what happens. His son slowly regains his health and his strength, and he enjoys taking on the physical labor of cleaning the stables, tending the estate, and he gradually is given more responsibility until his father reveals his identity and claims the son as his heir. And the father also reveals that before the son left home, the father had sewn a precious jewel into the hem of the son's cloak, the cloak that was now so ragged and stained, but the jewel was still there, sewn into the hem. But the young man was completely ignorant of it. So this is a parable, of course, about our practice, right? That when we are caught up in our greed and aversion and ignorance, we're blind to the jewel of our Buddha nature, which is with us all along, has been with us all along. So maybe some of us feel in awe, you know, of the great enlightened ones, past and present, and we can only see our hopeless delusion and our stubborn habit patterns, not knowing that that precious jewel of the Dharma is with us all along. But maybe for a while we need to see those jewels as external to inspire us to set out on the path. But we then need to see past the fine clothing and the jeweled footstool. We don't have too much ornate paraphernalia here at the Zendo, so maybe you don't have to worry about that too much. But there can be, you know, very impressive paraphernalia in a Dharma setting that can be awesome and yet insubstantial. So that second line, because there is the startlingly different, there are house cat and cow, needs a different translation. The characters that are translated as startlingly, means both frightening and wonderful, kind of like we use the word awesome. Both frightening and wonderful. And the character for different also means strange or extraordinary. So awesome, extraordinary is a good translation. So together they mean something wondrous, right? So these two lines, I think, are contrasting two different kinds of Zen practitioners. The first is the one who says, I'll never, you know, I'm such a terrible meditator, I can't, you know, I'm so impaired, caught in that sense of impairment and limitation. And the second is keen and quick to have insight and almost reaching, striving for enlightenment in a way that can become an obstacle in itself. And the verse seems to offer them, in contrast, these two animals. And the first is definitely not a house cat. The character is not even the character for cat. The character that's used here in Chinese or Japanese is actually an animal called a tanuki in Japanese. A tanuki is related to raccoon, and sometimes it's called a raccoon dog. And in Japanese folklore, he's a shapeshifter. He's a trickster. The character can also mean animals like that, like a fox as well, you know, trickster animal, or a wild cat, but it does not say domestic cat, so that we should change that. And the other, a white ox is a Zen, in Zen literature, is a symbol for the mind purified of obstruction, since you may have seen those ox herding, traditional series of, they're called the ox herding pictures, where the ox starts out black, and then it becomes sort of half black and white, and then it becomes white as the little monk chases the ox and tames the ox. But the point here, I think, that Dongshan is making, or one interpretation, is that we can't strive for enlightenment. It's not something that we can get and keep in that way. And that the tanuki, the wildcats, the foxes, the white oxen know it without getting it, because animals live in lessness all the time. If you live with a dog or a cat, or some other kind of animal, and you observe how they live in thusness in the moment, all the time, or almost all the time. So Dongshan is telling us in these lines that different people need different prompts and guideposts along the way, depending on whether our self-clinging is the self-deprecating or the self-inflating kind, right? So different people need different nudges and guidance along the path. Okay, continuing on, next line. Yi with his archer skill could hit a target at 100 paces, but when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? So Yi was a legendary archer in early China, over 4,000 years ago, a very long time, who was said to have shot 9 out of 10 suns from the sky to save the crops from burning up. So he was very skilled. And arrow points meeting in midair refers to another Chinese legend about a skilled archer and his student. The student had learned so much from his teacher that he decided that if he killed his master, he would now be the greatest archer in the land. So when he met his teacher on the road, he took aim, and shot his arrow, only to have it meet the teacher's arrow in midair. Both arrows fell to the ground. So the student, in that moment, awakened to his own selfishness, and his relationship with his teacher only deepened and matured. So you might recognize that image of arrow points meeting in midair as part of another poem that we chant called Harmony of Difference and Equality that goes, each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. So that's another way of using different images to express thusness, the way cause and effect come together in any moment in time and space, just this. Never to be repeated, just this. I love the Japanese expression that comes from tea ceremony, ichigo ichie, which means one meeting, one moment. One meeting, one moment. I Googled ichigo ichie just for fun. And what came up was an international chain of ramen shops called ichigo ichie. How wonderful. Beats Colonel Sanders and McDonald's. A chain of ramen shops called One Meeting, One Moment. Arrow points meeting. Skill no longer has anything to do with it. Just this. Just this moment. And in that moment, the next line says, when a wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. This is one of my favorite lines. The wooden man and the stone woman are images of the mind of non-discrimination, of self-clinging, dropped away, yielding a kind of freedom of expression. So a puppet made of wood or a woman carved of stone might seem inert or passive, and yet here they are depicted as singing and dancing, released from their inertia. You know, sometimes we're like that. We're kind of stuck in our as a wooden puppet or a stone person, and then we're released from that inertia. There's a beautiful verse written by Hongzhir, who was a 12th century Zen master, commenting on Dongshan's five ranks, which we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. He wrote this, the blue sky clears and the river of stars cold flood dries up. At midnight, the wooden man pounds on the moon's door. In darkness, the jade woman is startled from her sleep. I'm going to read that again. The blue sky clears and the river of stars cold flood dries up. At midnight, the wooden man pounds on the moon's door. In darkness, the jade woman is startled from her sleep. Right, so the darkness, remember again, is the realm of the reality of vast unity. So Dongshan reminds us once more, as he reaches the end of this poem, he says, it's not within the reach of feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration in thought? This is not something we can think our way through with our rational mind. And then he admonishes us, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial, and not serving is no help. Well, those lines probably don't sit so well with us in the 21st century, in our culture here in North America. Sounds very hierarchical and patriarchal. But in the Confucian world of ancient China, these were actually images of harmonious relationship. The two pairs are being used as a kind of code for nirvana and samsara, emptiness and form, absolute and relative, that are inextricable. So when it says, you know, the ministers and their lords, children and their parents, they're actually just two aspects. Not one, not two. Neither one nor two, both one and two, right? One of those paradoxical, Zen paradoxes. So then comes another of my favorite lines. Practice secretly, working within, like a fool, like an idiot. Remember the poem I mentioned earlier? When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble. Right? No need to show off. No need to prove anything. No need to become a celebrity, even in the Buddhist world. Right? And then he concludes the very last line, just to continue in this way is called the host within the host. The host within the host is one name for that fifth of Dongshan's five ranks or five positions, different aspects of the way we practice with that, with the relative and the absolute. The host within the host is where samsara and nirvana, the world of suffering and the world of freedom from suffering, are actually not separate. One and the same. You just keep practicing, day after day, kalpa after kalpa. You decline to become a noble. And just keep actualizing your practice in your everyday life. When we formally receive the precepts in the Jukai ceremony, there's a line where the teacher asks the student, even after attaining Buddhahood, will you continue to practice these precepts? Even after attaining Buddhahood, will you continue to practice these precepts? And then you say, yes, I will. This is the Bodhisattva way. To live in the midst of this big, beautiful, horrible mess of the world. One moment, one meeting. Just this. So, I hope next time we chant this poem that it will be familiar. And you'll go, oh yeah, that. Oh yeah, that. So thank you everyone for listening. What I'd like you to do is, as we usually do, get into small groups, not really small groups, maybe four. And so, and what I'd like, to invite you to do is just scan back over the poem and think what phrase or image from this poem would serve you as a good reminder to meet each moment. One moment, one meeting. What? And just any other reflections that you would like to share from this week or the previous weeks. What dharma will you take forward from this poem? Even if it's a question like, I don't get this. Okay, so just share some reflections and perhaps something that you would take along with you from this poem. Okay, so we'll thank the folks at Wall Street and those on Zoom, and we'll do that here at this sendo. Good night, all.